And welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional news and issues affecting our community, our region, our state, with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week, we welcome back to these microphones South Florida Sun Sentinel business reporter Doreen Hemlock. Welcome back, Doreen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We have a first-timer here on the panel today, and that is Nando Vila, who is director of programming at Fusion, an ABC Univision joint venture you may have read about. Nando, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
And also with us is an old friend, Miami Herald political writer Mark Caputo. Hello, Mark.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And as a bonus today, a late addition to our lineup, NPR's Mike Pesca, sports correspondent for NPR here covering the NBA Finals. And we'll be talking to him about what we saw last night and the Miami Heat. He is from New York, so we'll be gentle on him, or maybe not. Mike, welcome.
Happy to be your bonus. Your bonus pinata.
You're our Chris Anderson, if you will.
I'll give you 17 good minutes.
There you go. A couple of rebounds, a few points, we'll take it.
Hold on. Let me go get a tattoo.
So let's begin with the immigration debate and the discussion taking place in Washington or not taking place, as the case may be. Is Marco Rubio backing away from his own bill? The freshman senator from Florida made his usual Fox News appearance this week, and he admitted that on the show Fox and Friends that the bill that he and seven others, the Gang of Eight, have been shepherding through Congress is DOA, and the changes need to be made.
Do you believe that immigration, as it looks right now, will have the 60 votes necessary to move to the House?
No, and I think even the Democrats would concede that. And there's a few reasons for it, but one of the things we've learned over the last few weeks through the open and process that it happened through the committee process and all the public input that we've gotten is how little confidence people have that the federal government will enforce the law.
Rubio says he does not trust the Department of Homeland Security to enforce the law, forcing an influx of illegal immigrants. What's the deal here? We'll start with our new panelist, Nando Vila.
Well, it's interesting. He says he doesn't trust the Department of Homeland Security to enforce the law, but you know, actually, net migration is at zero right now, and it's been that way for a few years. You know, part of the reason is increased enforcement at the border. Other big reasons are just the economies of Mexico and the United States, and some big demographic trends in Mexico. You know, Mexico has seen the largest drop in fertility rate in recorded human history in the past 40 years. That's sort of eliminated or somewhat mitigated the push towards illegal immigration. But right now Marco Rubio is kind of in a tough spot. He's trying to thread the needle, so to speak. You know, it's clear that he wants to get this done. I think it's important for his political future to get this done, but he needs an escape route from in case he sees the conservative base rise up against it.
Marco Rubio, sort of hearing it from both sides now, and it was in fact on that Fox News appearance we just heard, they're accused by a conservative talk show host Laura Ingraham of dividing the GOP. Is he losing favor?
I'd say he's losing favor among some who wanted him to be as hardline as his rhetoric in 2010 led people to believe. But that 2010 rhetoric on the campaign trail was different from his previous rhetoric. So he's kind of flip-flopping on a flip-flop to a degree. He's kind of against what he used to be kind of for. He's playing it cute. He's playing both sides. He's possibly the best salesman for something he doesn't like or the worst salesman for something he does like. We'll have to see what happens. But in the end, he's probably going to back the bill. He's making a show so that this more border security can get added to the bill. But it's a show, because that increased enforcement is going to be in the House bill anyway. And there's a reason he's bashing the Department of Homeland Security. The House measure has the Government Accounting Office signing off on everything. So essentially, he's positioning himself to support the House bill that's coming out anyway.
So there'll be a resolution to this, do you think, soon?
Well, it depends on what you mean by resolution in this.
Well, a bill that will be passed through Congress and signed by the president.
I would not bet on that, and I wouldn't. I'm going 50-50. I'm going to cop out.
Meanwhile, here in Florida, Governor Rick Scott is catching some heat for his veto of a bill that would have helped children of immigrants who are not U.S. citizens get driver's licenses. He vetoed this bill on Tuesday, saying a White House policy linked to the measure was never approved by Congress. Another issue there between the state and the federal government. The bill passed unanimously in the Florida Senate and received only two dissenting votes in the very conservative Florida House. Senator Darren Soto, an Orlando Democrat who sponsored the Senate bill, said Wednesday he expects the fallout to continue.
There's a potential interest in asking for either a veto override or at least making known that we disagree with this veto and that Governor Scott should reconsider going into next year repeating his action.
So, Nando, what kind of message do you think the governor is sending here?
Well, you know, it's clear that he's trying to shore up his base. You know, Latino voters aren't going to like this in Florida. I mean, you know, it's largely a symbolic measure. It's not, it doesn't affect a huge amount of people. There's only 290,000 DACA recipients nationwide. So this is a relatively small number here in Florida. But it's not going to help his cause with Latino voters at all. I mean, you know, the Latino voters went 60-39 for Obama in 2012. That's slightly less than they went for on the national as a national average, but you know I just see this as a pure political play. It's not a real policy. It's not a real significant policy move.
It doesn't have too many implications. Right. Mark, you think that Governor Scott, after starting off on the right, moving towards the center, perhaps even towards the left, is now trying to make another right turn to kind of win back the Tea Party folks that may not be thrilled about what he's done lately?
That's a good question. I'd be guessing here. I'd have to agree. It is shoring up his base. In the end, the question is will this really matter to Hispanic voters or not? He almost carried them. I can't remember the exit polls, or perhaps he did carry them in 2010. In 2012, Obama was on the ticket. Obama's gone. It's an entirely different election. And in the end, the Republicans see this as more of a Republican-leaning year. So let's serve up a little more red meat. It's incumbent on the Democrats to actually show that they could actually win the state without Obama on top of the ticket.
And what do you think? Nando says it's going to be very unpopular among Latinos. Do you think that, despite the fact that this law doesn't have much teeth, that it sends a bad message?
Well, immigration is kind of a gateway issue for Hispanic voters on the whole, for them to start trusting or talking more to the Republican Party and voting more for their candidates. I think the polling has shown that. So anything you do that further blocks them from wanting to listen to is probably a bad idea. I spoke to a top Republican from Miami-Dade County, I cannot say his name, who, when I told him Governor Scott had vetoed this bill, he started to swear, wondering what is going on here, that basically it didn't make any sense. It's a Republican legislature that passed this bill almost unanimously. It's a policy that, on the whole, is viewed very sympathetically by broad swaths of the population. So for a lot of people, they're scratching their heads.
Doreen Hemlock.
There's already some Democrats that are organizing rallies around this and bringing Hispanics to their side. So it's
definitely, they're saying, thank you, Governor Scott. Veto it again.
And so many other states already have this. And you can get a license anyway, even if you are a dreamer. So it means nothing.
Nando?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key issue. I mean, if this would have passed, I mean, I think Governor Scott had sufficient political cover, given that it was unanimously passed in the Senate and almost unanimously passed in the House. So he had some, he could have, you know, given himself political cover on the right, and really he's just served up a, you know, an easy alley-oop from Democrats.
The other thing to remember is that he actually went out of his way to veto it.
Right.
As the governor, he could have done nothing and the bill would have become law without a signature.
Right.
So he put his fingerprints on this by vetoing it. That sends a message.
We're going to talk more about the governor's race, or lack thereof, at this moment, at least a bit later on, with Mark, who is the political reporter for the Miami Herald. One other big piece of political news locally here in South Florida this week, a South Florida congressman says the system is prone to fraud following the resignation of his chief of staff amid a voting fraud scheme. Authorities were investigating a sophisticated scheme to manipulate last year's primary elections by submitting hundreds of fraudulent absentee ballot requests by Joe Garcia, who won the primary and later was defeated by incumbent Republican David Rivera in the general election. The Miami Democrat Joe Garcia held a press conference last Saturday to do some damage control.
I cannot stress how angry I am about these events. I've marked my career on having a position of strength on these issues, and there can be zero tolerance for anything like this. No ballots were tampered with. No ballots were touched. I believe that while this was an ill-conceived effort, it was meant to expand voter access.
So, Mark, what's going on here?
Well, what's going on is Joe Garcia sticking his foot in his mouth after some staffers stabbed him in the back. If you've got staffers who are committing a form of elections fraud, don't call it a good idea at its core. He's had to now spend 2 days explaining that. But what's going on here is it looks like he had staffers. It looks like no one's been convicted or charged yet, who we're probably experimenting with ways to get infrequent voters to vote. They went online, allegedly, filled out confidential information, which is a felony if you're doing it as someone else or for someone else, and they had absentee ballots requested to these people's homes. Their motivations, again, we don't know. Whether, in fact, they actually did it, we don't know. We do know that three residences were raided in connection with two staffers, and its top chief of staff, top political advisor, Jeffrey Garcia, no relation to Joe Garcia, resigned. It is a horrible situation for the congressman to deal with, especially in Florida District 26, the most scandalous congressional district we had in 2012.
And you talk about that. Obviously, Joe Garcia elected because of the problems of David Rivera. And Republicans now suspect that Garcia had supported a Republican candidate to take away votes from Rivera in the 2010 election, which is what Rivera did that got him in so much trouble.
Republicans have a right to be a little angry. Here's a good example of the Federal Elections Commission not doing its job. There's very good evidence to show that this candidate, last name Arrojo, went out of his way to not file campaign finance reports, and despite a history of financial troubles, which are easily documented, somehow came up with $10,440 to pay his qualifying fee, and then somehow came up with more money to send out a mailer. It's very similar to what the now-convicted candidate from District 26 in 2012, Justin Lamar Sternad, did. Sternad got convicted in federal court. Arrojo's right now walking around free and barely got slapped on the hand. He got sent a letter saying, don't do this again.
It's a funny story, and obviously a lot of trouble with that congressional seat, District 26, as Mark just alluded to. I want to remind you that this is your show, too. I didn't mention that at the beginning, but you can always ring us up at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We have an email address. It is the floridaroundup@gmail.com. And you can also tweet us. We're very big on the Twitter, @WLRN, or you can go to WLRN.org. We actually have our guest producer, Marva Hinton, today blogging for us on our live blog, and that is a special event. Marva's doing that for us. Thank you, Marva. And you can certainly interact with her there and anytime online after we get off the air or during the show. I'm Phil Latzman, reintroducing our panel, Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald, Doreen Hemlock from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Nando Vila from Fusion, the new Univision ABC combination starting this fall, and with us also Mike Pesca from NPR. We're going to talk sports in a public radio way when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Our guest again, Mark Caputo with the Herald, Nando Vila with Fusion, Doreen Hemlock from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Mike Pesca from NPR. And we're going to talk to Mike in a moment. Your questions are welcome again. We are tweetable at WLRN. I'm at Phil Latzman, and all of you have Twitter handles as well. Mark, you give give yours out?
Yeah, mine's confusing. At Mark A. Caputo, and Mark has a C in it.
Mike, your Twitter address?
At Pesca Me, PESCAMI.
Nando?
At Nando R. Vila, VILA.
And Doreen?
At D. Hemlock, HEMLOCK.
And again, we have our live blog happening right now, and on our website, WLRN.org, all the time the conversation continues. It was a rough night in Miami, both from a weather standpoint and a basketball one. They're the final grim moments of last night's game at the American Airlines Arena. You can hear the audio groans, the audible groans, as the buzzer sounded. The home team lost Game 1 last night in Miami to the San Antonio Spurs, 92-88. LeBron James with a triple-double with 18 points, 18 rebounds, 10 assists, and we call it a Pyrrhic triple-double? Is that what, Mark, you just explained that for us?
I would say so.
Okay. He knows, though, LeBron, that the home court advantage now belongs to the Spurs.
You know, they came in and beat us on our home floor in Game 1, and I know they're going to be hungry to try to get 2. You know, so we have to be able to combat that and come back with a Game 2 plan that's better than Game 1 and even the series.
5 turnovers for the Heat in that final quarter after just 4 throughout the first 3 quarters. The final nail, Mike Pesca, a baseline jump shot by San Antonio's Tony Parker with 5.2 seconds left. It happened sort of right in front of us, although we were a little far away. Certainly looked like zeros on the clock to us, as it took up every single fraction of the 24 seconds of the shot clock. So Mike was awfully close. afterwards, the Heat head coach Eric Spoelstra joked that it seemed like 26 seconds, not 24. But what a way to end a game.
Yeah, it was one of those examples of what sports is becoming, which is forensic videography. We all studied that clock so closely. And the irony, maybe I'm not using that right, but the infuriating thing from a Heat fan's perspective is Spoelstra is probably right. It was more than 24 seconds because everyone is so concerned about when that 24-second clock stops. Starts, but when it starts, it's just kind of random. It's like in football when you measure to a millimeter if you had a first down, but the placement of the ball is like plus or minus 6 inches. Of course, Parker decides when he's going to start his penetration depending on what the shot clock says. So you could say whenever he was going to start the shot clock. And it wasn't only the fact that he got the shot off. Like LeBron said, Parker did everything wrong in that possession until the exact end when he did everything right, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, he kicked the ball, he bobbled he fell, he picked it up, and then he managed to go under and around LeBron, turn around, and make that shot. It was amazing. I mean, it really was, and a great game. So, Mike, you live in New York. By the way, game two Sunday night at the American Airlines Arena. You're here covering the NBA Finals for NPR. I believe you have a piece on All Things Considered this Friday afternoon. So, You live in New York. Everyone still hate us there in New York City?
Or? Oh, that's all New Yorkers do is walking around thinking about Miami. Wait a minute. Unless you rebranded yourself Boston, it's not the case.
So, but this New York-Miami rivalry, although we don't see it in the NBA Finals, or we thought maybe we'd see it in the East Finals, didn't happen.
Yeah.
But this is sort of the best rivalry in the sports world. I mean, there's such a brother Cain and Abel thing going on between Miami and New York.
Yeah, and it, of course, so much of it stems from when Pat Riley was the GM of the Knicks, and then he came down and wound up on the Heat. And it's great to have a rival. I think that, New York Knicks, the Knicks are more of a rival with themselves, and that we have an exciting new team in Brooklyn. And so even though the Knicks did better than Brooklyn, I would say the fundamentals, it seems like Brooklyn is this fun franchise that people can get behind, and they have a little bit of the upstart to them. It's, a little bit of smoke and mirrors. They spend $118 million on their roster like anyone else. But the Knicks still feel very corporate. And if they're not going to win games with their unbelievably highly paid roster, what is the point? How do you get behind them? You just do it because your father did it. And Walt Frazier was once a good player. This is the thing with sports. It's generational, and inside your DNA, you can't help it.
Well, you could all become Heat fans in New York.
No, they'd be like most New Yorkers, come down to Miami and complain how it's not New York.
Right. Well, that's true. Yeah. That's true. So, but really, no matter what, now, Doreen Hemlock, you've written some fantastic stuff recently about the Heat's impact on the community here in South Florida, at least financially and among businesses, and how these championship runs are really bolstering, sort of rising all tides, boats lifting all tides, however you want to say it here. I messed up the analogy, but tell us how this sort of relates to the Heat's success.
Well, I was trying to put a number on what's an NBA championship worth, and I started looking at all different variables, everything from the merchandise sold to the tourism to the value of the franchise, and the numbers just add up to tens of millions. Some people say hundreds of millions. For example, the NBA gives bonuses for each round that you get into in the playoffs. So it's the Heat already has $1.5 million just by making it to the finals, and they'll get at least $1.5 million just for being in it. The winner gets $2.3 million. Ticket sales, this Heat sold 18% more tickets for home games this season than last. And that makes them the only team in the NBA that can now offer a 3-year renewal package. The prices also of tickets have gone up. Since February, merchandise sales for the Heat are up 50%. The league's sales are actually down a little bit. The value of the Heat is up 37% in the past year. It's $625 million now. And that's faster growth than the value of other teams in the league. LeBron, he's now the number 2 paid athlete in the whole country. He's up from number 5 last year, according to Sports Illustrated. It's estimated he got $39 million in endorsements in the past year, up from $33 million the year before. And the numbers just keep adding on. You have the sponsors get more show on TV. For example, American Airlines, they estimate every game with just the TV exposure, they get more than $11 million worth of TV exposure. If they had to spend that much money for ads, it would be $11 million based on the value of advertising. And that translates into tourism for Miami. It translates into restaurant workers making more money, cab drivers making more money. So it's not just the team and the high-paid athletes that are making the money off of this. The head of Miami's tourism calls it Miami's summer stimulus package.
Yeah, no kidding. And this is certainly off-season for tourism. But the big sign that hangs out of the American Airlines Arena, people may have noticed, the LeBron MVP sign with the Nike swoosh on it, that is made by a local company. And you wrote about how much that cost and how much it helps that company's bottom line.
It's one of their biggest accounts. They also do all of the graphics inside the stadium, so they have to redo all the championship stuff inside. I think it's $20,000 at least for that banner alone.
Yeah, that's what it's a Hollywood company.
We shouldn't forget about the King of Diamonds
Metro
strip club.
Signs.
King of KOD strip club. Very popular. Floyd Money Mayweather apparently dropped like $100,000.
He, by the way, is the number one paid athlete.
That's part of the economy.
But I wrote a blog this week about for our website, WLRN.org, and if you want to check it out, you can do that. It may look like me being a bit of a shill, but I wrote it, you know, just to kind of thinking about how the Heat's fortunes have seemed to coincide with our region's economic recovery. Now, this is true. Since LeBron's decision to take his talents here, unemployment has dropped 4%. Home prices are up by about 24%. Even population growth is increasing. Nando, you think that's a coincidence?
Well, no, I don't. I think that. Well, how can you hate LeBron given those stats? I mean,
you'd be from Cleveland. Ask Mike Mexico,
like, why would you? You know, what's just because he said take my talents? Like, I mean, look, he's helping unemployment in South Florida. So.
Rick Scott has nothing to do with that.
Let's go to the business writer here because I know she's going to be the naysayer.
This is all scientific fact.
No, Rick Scott will really, really resent the idea that LeBron and not him is creating all the jobs.
Maybe LeBron will jump in the race next year and challenge Rick Scott.
I think you have offered a textbook example of causation and correlation being two different things. Yes, home prices have improved as the Heat's record has improved. You know, I think that basketball teams, sports teams, are really poor drivers of the economy. And it's just been shown time and time again that if municipalities can invest in anything, it shouldn't be sports teams. They're making a lot of money. The Heat are doing well. But we can't say that, therefore, you know, this can be replicated elsewhere. It was this kind of unique coming together, sui generis thing where LeBron went with this already established team. And the other very important thing about why the Heat is so profitable is that the NBA has a salary cap. So for all the capitalists in the NBA arguing sink or swim, LeBron James is so severely underpaid in terms of how much he generates for the team because there's a maximum that any player can be paid on a team. He is by far the most underpaid athlete in all of team sports. He makes up with some of it in his endorsements, but in terms of what the team can pay him, they're just using, like, really abusing
socialism.
Labor.
Socialism. It's sort of, in a way, socialism. But, you know, one final note on this for Doreen. The NBA Finals versus the Super Bowl. I had this conversation with our own business writer, Douglas Hanks of the Herald this week. Three straight NBA Finals, but Super Bowls not in our future. How strange is that? And can you make up for that? Does that take the sting away from not having a Super Bowl in South Florida, which just seems like a logical place to have the Super Bowl?
It does, but it also proves how we become a basketball town and not a football town.
But can it bring in the same economic? I mean, can three straight NBA Finals in Miami be equal to a Super Bowl or two Super Bowls? Can you do the math that way?
Well, I think to the extent that the NBA is going more global, much more than American football, in the long term, basketball is going to be a much more important sport than American football unless the NFL gets global in the same way.
I think weeks of postseason success is over many years is much better than a weekend. And, you know, the economists who study the Super Bowl, there's actually a big debate how much it brings. If you look at the tax records of the county that hosts it year to year, there's not much of a blip. It seems huge. It gets so much attention. But, you know, there's an offset, too. People don't go to zoos. People don't go to movie theaters. I think the Super Bowl, the economics of the Super Bowl is something that is vastly overhyped.
Well, it brings people in from out of town. And whereas the Miami Heat will mostly keep fans here, they don't necessarily travel. Maybe you'll get me from San Antonio, but, you know, the debate goes on and will continue to go on. Now, one of the other things we've been discussing here, Mike, is you come from New York and is the, I don't know if you know this, the Dolphins had a referendum that was scheduled to improve Sun Life Stadium before the Super Bowl was awarded that was struck down by Tallahassee. They did not get it. In fact, they had to call it off in the middle of early voting. There was $2 million left over from the Dolphins' failed stadium improvement initiative that Miami-Dade County will now have a chance to spend, and they started discussing that this week. We've got a lot of responses about funding programs for the elderly or the poor and the school system. Charles from Coral Gables says the money should be used to help pay off the huge debt already incurred by building the Marlins Stadium. And I don't think that's going to happen. Daniel Oppenheimer from Miami Beach writes, they should return the money to the Miami Dolphins. If the purpose goes away, the fund should be not viewed as extra and burning a hole in someone's pocket, so it needs to be spent. Return the money, show some morals and ethics. And then Ron writes us from Miami, Ron Mann, through the Public Insight Network, by the way, says it should be given to the Dolphins Foundation, one of the chosen charities the team works with. What do you think, Nando? What would you do with the Nando Vila? What would you do with that extra $2 million to put it to good use?
You know, I would
put you on a spot.
I would. I'd offer LeBron the $2 million to see if he would see if he play tight end for the see if he play tight. He is grossly underpaid, apparently. So, you know, maybe he wants to play tight end for the Dolphins and bring us a championship here. I think that would be good for the economy as well.
Sounds good. How about you, Mark? What would you do?
I would probably spend it on elections equipment. We were really embarrassed as a county. If not, I would probably spend it on. Assuming I was a government employee, I mean, if it's just given to me, I'd spend it on myself. A charity, I also think, is worthy. But look, it was money given for an election. Our elections here sometimes have been shameful, like in 2012. Let's buy some extra voting booths for folks.
Doreen, any ideas to cap it off here?
And I would add to Mark's and some people to staff them when the time comes.
That too.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Nice panel today. Mark Caputo from the Herald, Doreen Hemlock from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Nando Vila from Univision, the Fusion Network starting up this fall, the venture between Univision and ABC. And we'll get to that a little bit later on, talk about what that means for South Florida, which certainly could be an economic impact for our area. Also, Mike Pesca from NPR, the sports correspondent covering the NBA Finals with us. Here's something interesting, Mike, you may want to hear about. This is about these arcades that we have, these gaming machines that recently were declared illegal by the state of Florida. And in fact, a legal challenge to the law, the new law on video gambling machines, suffered a defeat this week. The owners of two Broward County senior arcades asked a federal judge to block key parts of this new law that banned internet cafes. Their attorneys argued the law was unconstitutional, vague, denies the First Amendment rights of senior citizens who gather at them to socialize. The judge, though, rejected those arguments. Now, Mark, this has become sort of a political football. We know this led to the resignation of Florida's lieutenant governor, Jennifer Carroll, a few months ago. How big an issue is this right now with these arcades being banned?
Well, it depends. For the arcades, it's big. But there's long been a very anti-gambling streak in Florida's Republican legislature, so this should come as no surprise. The reason this law passed, however, was the embarrassing or the massive arrests that had happened. The greatest quote ever with this was given by Hialeah's police chief, or better said, Hialeah's mayor, when pointed out that Chuck E. Cheese is technically an illegal gambling arcade. He said, "I'm not going to send the police to arrest Chuck E. Cheese."
Because they give out prizes that are worth more than 75 cents. Is that
But I got to say, if you're against gambling, don't send your kids to Chuck E. Cheese. It will turn them into gambling addicts. That's what it is.
Those delinquent skee ball.
Yeah, it's a gateway. Gateway gambling.
It's amazing. Do they have anything like that up in New York, Mike? Or
these little... So every state thinks, I used to cover gambling extensively, and of course every state thinks
this is your thing.
Yeah, just free money. And as more states do it, the diminishing returns, I mean, an economist would point to it. So now in the Northeast, used to be Atlantic City, was somewhat of an engine to that economy, but now there's gambling in Pennsylvania and gambling in Delaware, and they're all cannibalizing in each other. I just got back from Illinois. It's the biggest issue there. All these states think it's free money. Chris Christie, this will be a big political issue for the presidency, because Chris Christie wants to really expanded in Atlantic City, wants to be able to let you gamble online, wants to bring sports betting to Atlantic City, sees it as free money. I mean, maybe something unique and new like sports betting will be, but in general, this isn't just, hey, let's put some money in our coffers without any consequence.
You're listening to Florida Roundup. By the way, we're having some technical problems with our online chat at WLRN.org. We are taking the chat to Twitter. you know, taking our talents to Twitter. At WLRN is how you can find us on Twitter. And Marva Hinton, the very hardworking and talented Marva Hinton, will be engineering the discussion at WLRN instead of our WLRN.org. Now, one other thing that I want to talk about is not related necessarily to this, but the issue with the steroids in baseball, and this is a storm that's brewing right
Shock.
Here in Miami.
Shock.
The founder
of gambling in the establishment.
Yeah, well, here we go. Exactly. The founder of an anti-aging clinic in Miami with links to performing enhancing drugs and several high-profile players has reportedly agreed to talk to Major League Baseball. This guy's name is Anthony Bosch. He ran this Biogenesis of America, and apparently he's ready to sing like a bird about players like Miami's own Alex Rodriguez of the Yankees, the National League MVP, former National League MVP Ryan Braun, who's a former member of the Miami Hurricanes baseball team, now the Milwaukee Brewers. The New Times broke this story. Nando, any surprise that we are the steroids capital of South Florida, or the world here in South Florida?
Well, no.
We don't know if this is steroids. I should clarify. Whatever performance-enhancing drugs.
Well,
PEDs.
I mean, anyone who's seen this guy can readily sort of assume that he's kind of a shady character. All the facts haven't come out, but you know, the prohibition in sports for performance enhancing drugs is forcing athletes to go towards more creative solutions, or you know, more outside the typical mainstream. Drugs, for lack of a better term,
and trying to hide it.
There's just too much money at stake. I mean, the difference in, I mean, Mike probably the difference in between a batter batting 220 and him batting 280 is probably millions of dollars for him. I mean, the incentive is just way too high.
Or so, a guy having warning track power and then having home run power.
Yeah, and the cultural proscription against it is lax, and not only is it incentive. You know, I bought steroids in the Dominican Republic. It was quite an operation. I walked inside
you
a drugstore.
You look great.
Store.
By the way.
Thanks, man.
Yeah,
I walked inside.
Massive guns.
But the mood swings. I walked inside a drugstore and I said, "Could I have some steroids?" And they said, "Yeah, sure, because it's legal. It's legal all over in countries in Latin America. And when you have such severe poverty with these baseball academies, you know, it's widely been known that the agents who get these kids will put them on a steroids protocol or regime, and then maybe they'll knock it off by the time they get to the majors. But if they don't, they turn into maybe someone like Melky Cabrera, who, even if you factor in the fact that he's on this list, the fact that he was suspended and lost, you know, half of his season with the Giants last year, is still net positive something like $15 million in his career. Let's not even get into the A-Rod contract. If you look at who's going to be suspended from a baseball perspective this year, Johnny Peralta on the Detroit Tigers is probably the best player who was on the list. Ryan Braun's a great player, but his Brewers are out of it. They could probably drag out suspensions so that the players don't get hit this year. And one of the, if this goes according to what MLB wants, is saying, and so far all the leaking we've got is from, all the information is from MLB, and I think that they could probably mount a good defense in a number of ways, but it does seem that MLB is going to want to suspend players like Alex Rodriguez for 100 games, which is supposed to be a second offense. The first offense is taking steroids. The second offense is lying about it in the way they conceive of it.
50 plus 50.
Who knows if Alex Rodriguez is ever going to be healthy enough to play again. Oh, he's going to get paid. He's due $114 million no matter what. And even if he gets suspended for steroids, the Yankees are paying that contract.
And I think it's important to know, I mean, they did not, correct me if I'm wrong, they did not test positive for any of these steroids.
No, but that is, they don't, the reason that HGH was so very popular is that there was no test for it. So this was, you know, this goes back to Lance Armstrong's big argument about never having failed a test. The specific performance enhancers you took were unable to be detected.
Right.
So it's only a good argument if you don't understand the issues. And, you know, Ryan Braun did fail a test, and he did this whole offensive that was really aggressively pointing fingers and calling into question the character of the tester. Maybe that guy will be vindicated. Maybe this is, to me, Braun seems a little like Lance Armstrong, if all this stuff is true, because it's not just you got caught and said, "I'm sorry," which, you know, Bartolo Colon did and Melky Cabrera did and a lot of players have done. It's the going on the offensive and having a PR strategy that causes the people who accuse you to become victims. You know, if it's true that Braun did the steroids, that's, you know, kind of loathsome activity.
That's NPR's Mike Pesca, also with us, Nando Vila from The Fusion, a Univision ABC partnership starting this fall. Dorian Hemlock from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, business writer, political writer Mark Caputo of the Miami Herald. I'm Phil Latzmo. We'll come back. We've talked enough sports and games. We're going to get into some other politics, talk about citizens and the upcoming trial of George Zimmerman. Stay with us. And we welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Nice lively panel on this Friday. As some of us are in heat hangover mode after that game last night. We're going to move on, talk about some other stuff. By the way, it is Mark Caputo from The Herald, Mike Pesca from NPR joining us as our special bonus guest, our Birdman today, are coming off the bench. Nando Vila from Univision, a fusion cooperation with ABC, and Doreen Hemlock from South Florida Sun Sentinel. So in the backdrop this summer will be the trial of George Zimmerman taking place in Sanford, another hearing underway, in fact, in the George Zimmerman case today. Of course, he is the former neighborhood watch volunteer charged with second-degree murder in the fatal shooting of Miami Gardens teen Trayvon Martin. Now, we'll go back to the 911 tapes from last February, which should become a major issue in this case.
Does he look hurt?
I can't see him. I don't want to go out there. I don't know what's going on. So they're sending.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your number?
Just gunshots.
Still kind of gives you chills to hear that that 911 call. And the issue now with this is when you hear someone's voice, can you recognize whose it is? And you can listen to that backwards and forwards, left and right, to try and recognize the voice. And where I guess, you know, it's to be determined who that voice is. But Nando, this has become the central part of the setup for this trial as to whether or not it was Trayvon Martin shouting help or it was George Zimmerman shouting help and help in that audio clip we just played.
Yeah, and it seems like as far as I've read from from scientists that study this kind of thing, it is impossible to tell. I mean, there's only 3 seconds of uninterrupted voice being heard in that clip, and that's just not enough to make a positive ID, apparently. So everything else is getting into it now, like whether they're doing sort of character, they're trying to point out character flaws in Trayvon and George Zimmerman, both sides. It's one of those sort of.
Well, one of the things that we're going to see throughout this whole thing is what evidence will be introduced. I mean, what will people know about Trayvon Martin, who, by the way, is a local teen? It's our story here in South Florida. We're going to be doing some coverage on it, throughout this whole trial. But what will they know about his past? He was suspended from Crop High School in North Miami. He had smoked marijuana, which we'll talk about marijuana in a moment, but who knows, if that makes much of a difference in this trial. But will jurors hear that type of information? They're really going to rely on exactly what the judge allows, right?
Yeah, they were talking about whether they can include social media photos of jewelry and naked women on his room. I mean, there's all kinds of things that they're sort of contesting. It seems a little crazy to me that would have any sort of effect on whether someone would attack someone or not. I mean, it's just whether they like jewelry or smoke weed.
Yeah. The FBI voice examiner who tried to identify who was screaming in the background of that 911 call before Trayvon Martin was shot testified yesterday that could not be done by a respectable scientist. Meanwhile, Mark, we go back to the Stand Your Ground law, which is a controversial law in effect in Florida since 2005. You have the right to stand your ground, protect yourself. The efforts to change it in the 2013 legislative session went nowhere. We still have that law. It's still in effect, and it's still going to be prominently used by George Zimmerman's defense.
Right. The problem that the defense is going to have is the framers, the drafters of the Stand Your Ground law, say there's another part in Florida statute that says you're not allowed to be an aggressor. This is going to have to be decided by a jury, largely. I remember when the discovery came out in the case and we wrote about it. So I'm of two minds as to who's screaming on that audio. It sounds like a young person. It doesn't sound like the voice that you hear from Zimmerman, whose voice is deeper. Mm-hmm. But when you read the discovery, it seems pretty clear that Trayvon Martin was really doling out a butt-whooping on Zimmerman at one point. Now, who's the original aggressor? We don't know. No one was there. So I'm of two minds of that. Again, jury's going to have to decide that. And as for the evidence of marijuana and his previous fights and his conduct in school, that's largely going to be shielded by the jurors. Unless the prosecution screws up, brings mom on, or a relative, or someone who knows Trayvon Martin, and tries to make him sound out to be an angel. Then they could use that to kind of, in the words of Trayvon supporters, character assassinate him after the fact.
Now, I only bring this up because there's all kinds of talk of what might happen if the verdict is innocent or guilty or whatever. But jury selection begins Monday. And I think people remember the Miami riots in 1980 after the acquittal of police involved in the chase and subsequent shooting death of a man named Arthur McDuffie. So this sort of resonates here in a way, even beyond the fact that we have a guy our own teenager that was shot and killed. Do we honestly think that anything like that could happen 30 years later? I mean, Nando, you're shaking your head.
Well, I was shaking my head more because I was born after 1980, so I don't remember.
Must be nice. Yeah,
young, but no,
I mean, on the young youth.
I would be surprised. I would be surprised.
Yeah, we're not there. I mean, we're not where we were 30 years ago, you would think, on this type of stuff.
Thank God.
All right. Well, you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, and our guest, Nando Vila from Fusion, the Univision ABC Cooperation. And that begins this fall, by the way, Nando?
Yeah.
And it's going to be on your cable systems?
It will be on some of yours. You know, we're going to launch in the fall in some homes, and then we're going to ramp up distribution.
It is an English language network
catering
to Hispanics.
Yeah, that's the idea. The idea is that the vast majority of the growth of the U.S. Hispanic community in the future will be from native borns. And their primary language is English. They consume media for the most part in English. They live their daily lives in English. So there hasn't been a very strong national voice in English that sort of serves the U.S. Hispanic community ever. So this is the first time where anyone's ever really tried it.
Well, good luck with it. We look forward to seeing how it all turns out. I wanted to bring this up. Who knows if the people in your target audience smoke marijuana, but it's certainly possible. Florida Governor Rick Scott backing, and we just heard that 70% of people in the state of Florida, according to a recent poll, think that marijuana should be legalized here in the state for medical purposes. Thanks, Mark. Anyway, Rick Scott signed this bill this week, the proposed bong ban, which makes it illegal for shops to, quote, knowingly and willfully sell marijuana pipes known as bongs for use to consume illegal drugs. The wording of the bill has led some to question if the devices could be still sold if the expressed purpose was to smoke tobacco. Now, during Hemlock, we walk into stores all the time and we see these funny-looking things, glass bongs all over the place. I mean, it seems probable that they would not be sold. You could use them for tobacco, right?
I guess you could. I mean, it just heightens the debate on the whole issue of legalization of marijuana, and that debate's just going more and more international. Recently, there was a meeting of Latin American leaders, and they were trying to figure out what are they going to do, because the crime related to drugs in Mexico and Central America has gotten so bad that more and more former presidents and are speaking out and saying, let's decriminalize it.
You think that's, I mean, in the state of Florida, do you think, Nando, that could ever, ever happen? I mean, how many years away in a place like this are we from anything like that happening?
It's hard to say. I mean, a majority of Americans overall support full legalization of marijuana, 52% according to the Pew Center for Research and Studies. These things, it's hard to predict. I mean, sometimes change happens. It seems like it's happening very slow, and then there's a tipping point. It happens very quickly. I mean, we've seen the same thing happen with the attitudes towards same-sex marriage on a nationwide level. Here, you know, it definitely seems like it's probably a lot more difficult, but it's hard to say with any sort of certainty.
And you have pointed out to us in prepping the show is that blacks, African Americans, five times more likely than whites in Miami to be arrested for pot possession.
Yeah, and pot consumption between blacks and whites is roughly the same. I think it's 14% nationwide for blacks and 12% for whites. But arrests are five times more likely to be a black person. I mean, and it just at this point, marijuana is so accepted in our culture in many ways. I mean, you look at any TV show or movie. You know, our past three presidents have admitted to smoking marijuana. It's gotten to the point where to spend billions of dollars to arrest and combat the sale of marijuana on a nationwide level is becoming increasingly, hard to
justify.
And Doreen, if they were to sell marijuana and tax it, wouldn't that make billions of dollars for? I mean, this is an argument that's been going on for years, but if they make marijuana legal and they tax the crap out of it, and you've got billions of dollars of new revenue coming into your coffers.
I think that's what California and some of the states in the West are counting on. Medical marijuana is a good industry.
The irony is that marijuana was made illegal as a result of the 1934 Marijuana Tax Act. So there you go. We're kind of coming full circle. The polling does indicate that if this made the ballot, it more than likely would pass medical reasons. The polling also shows that depending on how you ask people, they actually do support legalization as long as you don't say it's legalization. It's one of those things.
Decriminalization?
It was along the lines of essentially, do you think people should essentially be given a small equivalent of a speeding ticket for smoking marijuana in public? And the answer was yes. But you saw the opposition isn't strong. There is a ballot initiative that's going on. It's a tight time frame to get it on the ballot. But I think if it makes it, it'll pass. It's a 60% threshold. And again, it looks like right now it's about 70%, albeit there's going to be opposition. So
this is something
that
would be on next year's ballot
in Florida?
It could be.
They have to get the requisite amount of signatures. And I think that's something like almost 670,000 signatures of registered voters. So it's a lot.
Does anyone know if law enforcement or anyone says that a bong ban will actually do anything to lessen marijuana consumption, considering you could make a bong out of any substance on earth?
Right. Apples.
Like what?
Apples. Aluminum foil.
Quick question, Mark. Why did the governor
Not that I know,
but, yeah. veto it? So, okay. Why did he ban this?
There could be a naked political reason. He wants to be tough on crime. Also, Governor Rick Scott's brother has struggled with drug abuse for quite some time. I believe his father was also an alcoholic, so he also has a personal reason for being hard on drugs.
All right, so we're going to wrap this up, but as long as we have you, Mark, as the political writer for the Miami Herald, you'll be writing your Monday column and do a fantastic job covering the comings and goings of politics in Florida. We only have one declared candidate to oppose Governor Scott right now in next year's. We have more than that?
Oh, yeah, we got a bunch.
Well, I mean, one legitimate.
There's a crazy guy who owns a Hallmark card store in Broward, by the way.
Okay.
Take his calls.
So he's probably going to buy a bong at some point. But no, just kidding. But Nan Rich, she's the former Senate Minority Leader from Broward. She's really the only legitimate candidate to challenge. Now, we're just waiting for that Charlie Crist guy to decide whether or not he wants to be in. He's now a Democrat. Does Alex Sink get back in the race? What's going on here?
I think Charlie probably does. Alex Sink probably doesn't. Polling indicates that Charlie Crist would probably beat Rick Scott, but there's a reason you have campaigns. And as Mike Tyson said, everyone's got a plan, and then they get punched in the mouth.
And what's your column on Monday going to be about?
I'm still figuring that out as we speak.
Maybe we give you some ideas. Doreen, what are you going to be writing about in the South Florida Sun Sentinel?
The business of nonprofits, an area of the economy people don't pay much attention to, but makes up in the U.S. in general about 5% of the whole economy, and about 1 in 10 jobs is a nonprofit.
We pay attention to it around here, believe me.
Healthcare. Yes.
It's right up our
alley.
NFL. Yeah, right.
It is a nonprofit.
Nando, what do you got planned? We just talked about the venture there, but what are you up to?
Well, we're looking at two big stories. One is this NSA leak that they're monitoring all our cell phone calls. The other one is that there's a cat who's running for mayor in a Mexican town, and he's polling higher than any of the human candidates. The candidato.
Well, that's a great way to end. Mike, you got to top that in some way. Do you want to? I'm going to put you on the spot. Give us a prediction on the NBA Finals while you're here.
I think it's going to go to 7, so I'll see you in a couple weeks.
7, and who wins?
LeBron James,
Miami.
Great. So.
Okay. All right.
7?
All
yeah.
Right. 7. Heat and 7. I had Heat and 6. And Dorian, what did you have?
My heart, Heat and 4.
Okay, Heat and 4. Well, that's not
bold prediction.
Work out.
They could win the next 4. Whenever they lose the first game in a series, they've always won the next.
That's true.
4.
I don't think anybody's beaten the Heat 2 straight times. I can't remember. It's been many, many months. All right. Well, that's Mike Pesca from NPR. Good to have you here, Mike. Thanks for
Thank you for having me.
Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald, the political writer. Always good to have you here. Nando Vila, great first appearance for you, and we wish you good luck on the new venture there with Fusion.
Thank you so much, Phil.
And Doreen Hemlock from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Great to have you back on the program. It's been a while.
Thanks for having me.
And that does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, June 7th, 2013. If you missed any of it, we do have it again on these airwaves Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. We also post it on our website, WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup, Today, produced by Marva Hinton, with help from Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman, our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Firro. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. Thank you, Paul. South Florida Arts Beat next on a Friday. We have only a game if it is Saturday morning. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Phil Latzman, and stay informed, South Florida. Oh, go Heat.